time to think about, well, what's the point of, not what's the point in a bad way, but hold on, I'm still very early in life. What do I want to do with my time? I'm working 70 hours a week to be shouted at by somebody who's not very nice. And I'm kind of not getting through to these kids because I've not got time to do all the emotional intelligence, juggling, problem solving stuff that I know I love from my volunteer work, because I just keep being told off that I need to do English and maths.
My name is Paul Harvey, and this is Life, Passion and Business. We're about helping you explore, finding your passion for life and the work that you do. But it's so much more than that. It's about finding clues to the big life questions. What does it mean to be successful? What is the meaning of life? If you're looking for more, then join me on this journey, where together we will discover through interviews, tools and tips how to live life full of meaning, passion and purpose. Let's talk about education. I'm sure everybody has a view on education, be it their own or their children's. I've spoken about my own education in the past about this program, and it came from a place and a time when children were shamed and blamed. Thankfully, that style of teaching has gone, and it did not dull my desire to learn and go on learning. But you see, our ability to learn is a fundamental part of being human, and yet the education system seems to struggle to find the right balance. In the UK, there are thousands of amazing teachers all doing their best in a system that doesn't work for them or the children they're teaching. One of my heroes of the cause was the late Ken Robinson, and he died last year. And throughout his life, he challenged the system both here in the UK and in the US. And while those in charge listened and made the right noises, little has changed. As past trustee of an independent school, I come to this subject with a little bias. So our conversation on this show is about the joy of learning and how education is a skill that we need for life. It's also about personal development and transformation, the discovery of skills that support the bonding with people, making friends, and ultimately building a better world. Gemma Perkins, my guest, wanted to be a teacher since her first days in primary school. She is the oldest of four siblings. Her brothers and sisters are on the autistic spectrum with high-functioning Asperger's syndrome, and they were taught at home. So coming home from school, she would practice her teaching skills with them. And during the holidays, she joined in with their classes by supporting their teachers as an assistant. This set her on the path to becoming a teacher or teaching, but not as she expected. Still with the teaching in mind, she went to Sheffield University and studied psychology, neuroscience, and clinical psychology for child development. At college, she was given the opportunity to take part in a leadership program run by a charity that provided personal development services. That is what opened the door for her to discover who the real Gemma was. She went on to become a volunteer for that company and supported the program, and it became a fundamental part of her life. After university, she went on to get a teaching degree and eventually found herself in front of a class of children. It was fantastic. And then she discovered the reality of school life and where it clashed with her values. What was required by the school was not necessarily the best for the children. It took a while, but eventually she tendered her resignation. Following some family tragedy, she took a break from work and went to London to support a leadership event. And that was where an opportunity presented itself, and she has never looked back since. Today, Gemma is a teacher of leadership and self-mastery. She is passionate about learning and development. And through her company, she seeks to highlight the true potential of as many lovely humans on this planet as possible. Let's join our conversation with Gemma Perkins. So welcome to the program, Gemma.
Thank you very much for having me, Paul.
So what's been the story for you? This is Life, Passion and Business. We are all about exploring how life, how the cards played out, how the dominoes fell. What happened to you? What was your dream when you were young?
My dream for the longest time was to be a school teacher, more specifically doing special educational needs. And that came about because I loved primary school myself. I was one of those Hermione Granger type busybodies who every time we learned something new, I soaked it up and I wanted to tell everybody else.
Oh, can I have more work, miss? Can I have some more homework? Yeah, I bet you were popular.
But more so out of school, like in school, at primary school, back in my generation, it wasn't a problem to be a bit of a nerd. It was only when I got to secondary school I had a tough time of that. But when I got home, I had two younger brothers and a sister, so I was forever teaching them stuff, or trying to at least. But all of my siblings are on the autistic spectrum in varying degrees, and so
did you escape that then? Were you? Did?
Yeah. So I'm quirky, but nothing. Nothing clinically diagnosed. I don't have the same social issues.
So for the benefit of listeners, and I'm sure we've all heard this before on some level, but from someone who's experienced it, what is autism? What does it mean?
Well, it's really important to be aware that it's a spectrum, and not every autistic person will be the same. So one of my brothers and my sister would be diagnosed as Asperger's, which is a milder form of autism.
Yeah.
And they're all technically high functioning, which means that if you bumped into them, to look at them, to have a quick conversation, you wouldn't necessarily go, oh, there's something different there. Whereas some people who are autistic, you can tell that they can't take care of themselves. So there's really a lot of diversity within autism that needs to be appreciated. But what it means for them is that they take things quite literally. They struggle to read social cues. They have some difficulty with aspects of independence and life skills unless they get a lot of like repetitive teaching and instruction. So when I was about eight, my youngest brother, I can't remember how old he'd been, maybe three, he had play therapists come round because he had no speech and language. He didn't know how to play. He didn't really understand yes and no. There was some difficulties toilet training. So basically, all the basics took a lot longer. And he has texture issues with his food, or he's a lot better now. He's an adult now. But there were just things that you might take for granted as part of normal human or child development that needed extra work. And so it was really interesting for me watching these play therapists. And actually, when I was on school holidays, I used to love joining in with them. So they would be doing structured activities with my brother, and I would be their little assistant and things like that. So that kind of embedded for me that I want to be an educator. That's kind of where that passion came from, and also I guess a fascination with people and the mind. I wouldn't have articulated it like that at 8 years old, but certainly looking back, I was very interested in how people learn and what help people need.
But you can really see how that, because that's quite formidable years, and seeing how your brother and family around you, it would have been very obvious that you would fall into that, because it's like helping your brother and helping people like your brother. It's interesting how that developed. So obviously you went through education, asking for more homework, and then you ended in university. Did you go to university? I guess you must have to become into teaching.
I did, yes. Yeah. So I'd still got in mind that I wanted to be a teacher up until I was about 25. So I decided to, rather than study teaching, because I wanted to work in primary schools, I decided to study psychology, which is brain's behavior. I didn't actually appreciate how broad psychology was when I got into it, actually, because certainly I went to Sheffield University and we did neuroscience, how all the nerves in the brain, impact you chemically, impact patterns of behavior, as well as the social stuff, as well as clinical psychology, such as how do we tackle things like depression, anxiety, and all sorts of other, I guess, what would be known as disorders, but now we're seeing them as part, again, of the spectrum of mental health. There's positive mental health, there's challenging mental health. So I wanted to study that because I had a particular interest in autism, as you might have guessed, and thought learning about child development, attachment, and all of that kind of stuff would really support my, going into education. And it worked out really well that I did my psychology degree, and then when I applied for my 1-year teaching degree, and they said, well, you didn't study maths, English, science, how does psychology help? I could say to them, actually, I've done a lot of essay writing, that's my English. I've done statistical analysis of research papers, that's my maths. And psychology is a scientific study. You know, you can read some pop psychology on the internet, which is not so scientific, but the way it's done properly in peer-reviewed journals with a hypothesis, with, you know, testing what happens, it is a scientific field when it's done right. So I could demonstrate from an education point of view that I kind of ticked all the education boxes, as it were.
Mm. Oh, clever. And where did that lead you?
So actually, although that did lead me exactly where I was planning to go, the more interesting story is what happened on the side. Mm-hmm. So because I knew from a young age I wanted to do education, when I was maybe 14 and I did my work experience at secondary school, I did that in my local primary school. I volunteered throughout my college to help a day a week at the special educational needs unit of another local secondary school. So I always did a lot of volunteering on the side, being the Hermione type, which actually I really recommend to any young people, because I feel like I got more from my extracurricular stuff than I did. You know, the education was good, but there's something different about being in the real world and seeing it being applied that really needs to be valued more.
Yes, I agree. There's a massive opportunity in the volunteer sector to learn so much and to gain so much from that sort of thing, yeah.
And so when I was at college, I remember in form time being sort of told, oh, you ought to be doing lots more volunteering or extracurricular things. And I was like, well, I've got a few, but I've got room for some more. And they said, we've got Duke of Edinburgh Award or this leadership program. And it was a little bit flippant of me, but I kind of went, well, I don't like camping, so I'll do the leadership one. And that really, looking back, is a turning point for me, because that's what my business now is, and I wouldn't have guessed it at the time. So I turned up to this residential, and I had a really tough time in secondary school. Primary school, it was cool to be a nerd. Secondary school and the start of college, I really got outcast. I perhaps didn't help myself by being a little bit snooty at the time. I really wanted to learn, and I was very judgmental of people who didn't. I couldn't empathize with their point of view, and I got bullied quite a lot. It took me a long time to learn about having my own needs met in terms of my education whilst not ruffling feathers, and whilst you know, appreciating, okay, they don't want to do stuff, but as long as they're not bothering me, let's not cause a problem. So I really didn't enjoy the social aspect of secondary school, and that made me quite a shy teenager when I got to college. I found it very difficult to meet new people, because I almost expected people not to like me, because that's the experience I'd had for a number of years. So I kind of had kept my head down for the first bit of college, maybe three months or so, turned up to this leadership program, and we did all sorts of stuff about understanding your personality type, how do you set goals, what do you value in life, and not just, okay, what job do you want to do? I'd done enough of that in school, but it was like, no, what experiences do you want? What are your other life goals? And nobody really asked me that before. And we did loads of teamwork exercises where I suddenly started to realize, this is my pattern in a team. This is the kind of thing, you know, I like to come up with the ideas and take charge. And while that is good at times, I'm sometimes doing it in a way that comes across as, you know, bossy. And I'm careful with that. You know, they say use the word assertive, but actually I was being bossy. And when I realized that, I could then say, right, now I can choose. Do I still want to do this, or do I want to adjust my behavior? And I met one of my best friends on this course as well. So we're still friends now, and I hang out with her and her family all the time. But it just really opened my eyes to what I now know to be a world of emotional intelligence and self-awareness. And I kind of thought, I really wish I'd learned this when I was younger.
What is amazing about this is that you've taken an extracurricular activity about leadership, and it's fundamental to the reason of being here and living. And it's why isn't that fundamentally in education to start with?
Exactly. And that is absolutely my soapbox topic all the time. I get very distressed about the education system, which is a problem for somebody who always wanted to be a teacher. So anyway, yeah. I did this program. I got so much out of it. And the chap running it, who's a very good friend of mine now, and one of my mentors in life, he said, if you've enjoyed it, you can come back and mentor others. I was like, great, this is exciting. So I on a regular basis, give up weekends to peer mentor others. And eventually I kind of said, oh, you know, I've been mentoring a long time. Can I run a game? Can I deliver a bit of the training? I noticed that you don't have any paperwork or handouts. If we typed up like what we're teaching them, they could take it away and keep using it. And so on a voluntary basis, I ended up being, you know, a personal assistant, a training provider through this volunteer organization. And this was all alongside doing my A-levels, doing my degree, doing another side project. I did a night course in counseling because my psychology teacher at A-level said, you probably find it cool. Go and have something to do at nighttime. So I did all these bits and pieces.
Gosh, and then you were Hermione. You were so...
but I think I'm very fortunate that I was raised to enjoy learning. And not everybody is. And to me, I did all those things because I loved them all. And I really saw the benefit of them. And I know, again, from my own teaching career, that some people get the message that school is just something you have to do to get the job.
There's a passion in there somewhere. What is the passion for you? What is it about?
I think the passion is just the joy of learning. I think learning is exciting, and I do find it upsetting when there are people who believe that learning only happens in a school, because actually learning happens everywhere. And there are some people who, again, you maybe get the impression that, oh, I've finished that course, so I don't have to do anymore. And it's like, well, why wouldn't you want to keep learning? Because it keeps the mind fresh. It's exciting. When people teach me new things, I kind of get giddy and I want to go and tell somebody else about it.
I want to push you, because it's like, yeah, the joy of learning is, I appreciate the joy of learning, isn't it? But what is the joy of learning? What is it about that is so exciting? See, all right, for me, my passion is moving people forward. I will have a conversation with someone and I will see the lights go on when I say something, and they go, yeah, I could do that, couldn't I? And it's like, I realize that that's the reward I get, is that sense that, hey, the light's just gone on that subject. They can change. Mm. They know they can change. And for me, that gives me a little furry feeling, you know, a little warm, fuzzy feeling inside. You know, where's your warm, fuzzy feeling coming from?
So definitely in my work, the warm, fuzzy feeling is similar to yourself. It's that, okay, the penny's dropped and I can use this to make my life better. That's definitely the idea of personal transformation, or somebody who had a problem who now is empowered to fix it.
Yes.
That is definitely my main warm fuzzy. But then I also quite like, and I can't think of a very good example, but there are some things where I'm not going to use that knowledge, but wow, isn't it just cool that this is the way the world works and that we've managed to work that out? There's something about the mystery of the universe that we live in, and the fact that actually we do know lots, but there's still so much we don't know. And that is cool.
Yeah.
Like a daft example, I'm sure I've heard somewhere that we know more about space than we do about the deepest part of the sea. That's mental. But the fact that that's unusual is exciting, because it says that the world is complex and that makes it interesting, and that we are complex. And I love, when I was teaching, like teaching a child to read and write is fascinating, because there's so much involved about visually recognizing the letters versus knowing what sounds they make versus comprehending the words. And when you see those things pieced together, especially over time, such as, okay, 1 week they can't get this bit, but 3 weeks later they've got it, you kind of go, wow, the brain is cool, as if we're built to be able to do this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, it's just exciting.
So you're in college, you're in this project, you're being the PA, you're doing all sorts of stuff here, which I actually should have written half of this stuff down because it's a huge list. Okay, so what else happened? What next?
I developed a really good working relationship with Krish, who was the gentleman that ran the leadership.
Mm.
And there was stuff going on with my family. My mum and dad didn't have a very happy marriage. And as the oldest of four siblings, I've always had a bit of a mother goose thing going on, that it's my job to look after everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And I sort of said to Krish, we're a low income family. You know about training and therapy. Can you teach me family therapy so that I can help them out? Because, you know, there's a really awkward atmosphere and I want to be helpful. And it's just one of the most beautiful lessons in life that I've ever experienced, because he said, yeah, we can do that. You know, I drove at the time. So he said, you pick me up from this job once a week, and then we'll spend an hour or so working through Virginia Satir, The New People Making, which is a family therapy book. It's a kind of communication tool book. So we, I can't remember how many weeks for, at least eight, it feels like, but it could have been longer. And we learned all sorts of tools, and we talked about how I could use them to set up little communication activities to help everybody at home understand each other better. But then at the end of all of it, the main thing I took away was that it wasn't my problem. And I don't mean that in a bad way, but he could have just said to me, as the more mature person, as somebody with a lot of world experience, you know, Gemma, you're 19, it's not your job to fix your family. I'm not going to do this for you. But instead, he put the time into teaching me anyway. And along the way, there was a coaching process that allowed me to recognize I can do it if I want to, and I'm equipped to do it if I want to, but I don't have to. It's a responsibility I'm putting on myself.
I've only known you for 10 minutes, but I know full well that if he'd have told you it's not your problem, you'd have gone, yes, it is. You'd have dug your heels in. I'll go and find someone else to teach you. If you won't, that's what you'd have done.
But and that's the lesson of coaching.
You didn't say no to that, did you? You didn't turn it. You didn't say no. You're completely wrong.
No, there's a fair point there. But that definitely taught me a lesson about what it means to coach somebody.
Yes.
Is that you have to walk alongside somebody from where they're at, and you're quite right. Where I was at, that I decided that's what I was doing, and if he'd have said no, I wouldn't have moved on in my journey. So by him walking alongside and following that process, I learned more about myself along the way than just being told what I needed to hear. If I'd have been told it up front, I wasn't ready.
Mm.
And so I've always loved that and tried to embed that in my practice, that, you know, coaching and going at people's pace and helping them discover things slowly and in a safe environment is really the key to personal transformation. So that sort of stuff was going on. I did end up doing some work with my family, but with the freedom that I'm doing it because I'm choosing to, not because I'm obliged to. And that was the difference. At the beginning, I felt I have to because nobody else can, or will, or whatever it was. So I got to be a primary school teacher. And
oh, did you went into education then? I was surprised I didn't think you'd do that.
So I did get there, but not for long. I was a bit late. I had a gap between my degree and my teaching degree because I kind of missed the round of applications. I was so busy concentrating on doing my degree properly, I forgot to apply for the next one.
Oh, yeah.
But actually, it worked out really well because I had a year of experience in schools as a teaching assistant. Then I did my teaching degree, which was an immense amount of fun because the staff there they did the lessons on us like we were children, and some people found that a bit annoying, but me being the nerd I was, absolutely loved, like, let's do finger painting to learn maths and let's do, you know, science experiments. So it was really good. Got to a school that was lovely area, on the whole lovely set of children, but the leadership of the school I didn't realise until later was quite toxic. And it was just, I would guess there's about 25 staff in this primary school. And over the space of the 2 years that this head teacher had been running it, about 18 staff had left. And so really high turnover because of this toxic culture. And being a new teacher is quite difficult because you think teaching is about education, but it's actually about a lot of paperwork, a lot of data, and a lot of government politics and things like that, which I wasn't expecting. And I'm quite an organised person. I could have navigated it, but I was really feeling it not sit well with my values. And there were things like, we were told to implement one way of teaching or one way of marking books, but with really vague expectations, guidelines, like, oh, we need you to come up with these success criteria, such as what makes a good lesson. And you have to write it in every child's book at the start of the lesson so that as you're teaching them, they know what you're teaching them. And then at the end, they tick off, have I learned what I've... And it's still all a big waste of time. And we'd come up with a system and then she'd say, no, no, I didn't want it like that. But you left it up to us. We came up with something, and now you're telling us in very not nice language that, you know, you don't like it. You wouldn't talk to a child like this. Why talk to your staff like this? Very demeaning. So there was all sorts of culture stuff going on, and I handed in my resignation, which got lost. So I had to stay a lot longer than I was hoping, because there's all sorts of... you have to give quite a long notice period in schools because of school terms. And then there were two family deaths kind of in a row. So one was my grandmother, who was not a nice lady, we were not very close to. So it wasn't particularly traumatic, but it was reflective. And then my sister's boyfriend, who was 19 or 20, died of brain cancer. And that was very heavy going on the family. And so there was a lot of time to think about, well, what's the point of, not what's the point in a bad way, but hold on, I'm still very early in life. What do I want to do with my time? I'm working 70 hours a week to be shouted at by somebody who's not very nice. And I'm kind of not getting through to these kids because I've not got time to do all the emotional intelligence, juggling, problem solving stuff that I know I love from my volunteer work, because I just keep being told off that I need to do English and maths. And so I took a break one weekend from my very busy week to go down to London and do a leadership training program with Krish and all my colleagues there. And Krish said, by the way, I'm moving house. I live in Sheffield. Most of what we did was in Sheffield. And he said, I'm relocating to London. And we had this moment of, if you go to London, is all the training going to stop? Like, we really had a sense of family, community, and that we were doing something worthwhile and fulfilling. Every time we did one of these residentials or workshops, I came away really buzzing and that I'd made a difference to somebody. And he said, well, you know, if you like it so much, why don't you set up your own organisation in Sheffield? And because of, in some ways, it was a blessing that school was so tough and that there was a lot that I didn't like, because I think if it had been passable, I'd have stuck with it, because starting a business is not something to be done lightly. But I think in that moment, I realised the education system as it is now is not for me. It's not the right time. And so I want to get out of it and spend my time doing the bits that I believe in, which is helping people discover who they are and to learn all the stuff that my family struggle with about communication and not getting into conflict, all the stuff that I'd see made a difference that isn't on the curriculum. And I can't work out why it's not on there, because it's so important.
There's a lovely quote. I mean, I was involved with the Steiner School with my son's education for many, many years. And there was a lovely quote that was circulated a lot of that time. And I can't remember where it came from. I can't remember now. But the quote goes something like, education is the lighting of a fire and not the filling of a pail. You know, and it so rang true with me. And that was very much his education, his experience in Steiner School. And then he had the antithesis of that when he went into mainstream education at a certain point.
Yeah.
And he having explored both sides, he's incredibly critical of mainstream education. I mean, it's gotten to where he is now, but he recognizes that he would be less of a person without his Steiner background, which was very much about the lighting of a fire.
Yeah.
And I can understand your loss on that one, because it's like you want to educate the children and give them that, that passion for learning, and the system don't let you.
No. No, and I think obviously there's a lot of individual teachers, there's a lot of individual schools that still build that in, but on the whole, you're swimming against the tide, which changes with the politics.
Yeah, but it's exactly the same stuff that Ken Robinson was talking about for years. I mean, you know, because Ken Robinson died last year, I think it was 2020 sometime, you know, and I know I'm just listening to his daughter speak about him, his work and stuff, and he's been banging the same story on for 10 or 15 years. And every government turned around and go, yes, Sir Ken, you're right, we should do something about it, and do nothing.
And I get that, you know, schools are one of the biggest parts of society. You know, the number of schools up and down the country, to change one thing in every school.
Do you know what I think the issue is I think the issue, the problem is this desire and push for qualifications and for measurable outcomes. I think that's what it is. Because if you could allow people to just be people and learn what they need to learn, and the fact that some people will be intellectually amazing and will be able to suck in this stuff and pass exams, and other people won't.
Yeah.
And they have to do something else in life. They have to learn another, they have to learn another way through. And society is not built like that. Society requires us to have bits of paper.
And the measurement in of itself is not a problem, but it's what are you measuring? Because some places measure happiness, some places measure emotional intelligence. You can measure other things.
Johnny can do his 8 times table or what have you. I don't even do times tables anymore thinking about it. You know, showing dating my age.
No, they do. They're back in fashion. It's very much... that by year 4 they have to be able to do them in a certain speed with a certain level of accuracy, otherwise they have to kind of resit them. So it's a bit punitive. There's a lot of stuff. I'm more familiar obviously with primary education than I am secondary, but there's a sense that if you can't pass the phonics at age 6, you failed at reading. And even though you wouldn't get a piece of paper that says you've failed, the culture around it is you aren't good enough for your age, which drives me mental.
A lot of in mainstream Europe, you don't start learning until your letters until you're 7. You don't start reading until you're 7.
There's this idea of, there's an average. Oh, you're below average, sort it out. Hold on, somebody's got to be below average. That's the nature of an average. What are you on about?
We've all got to be the same. That's what it means. We've all got to be above average and the same. There's no average. How does that work? Because if everyone gets better, the average just goes up.
Exactly.
You're chasing an impossible dream here.
Yeah. And some people are slow starters. I mean, one of my friends at university was a mature student, and they were ready to study then. And they did a fantastic job of it, and they got a first because that was the right time for them. If they'd have done it when they were 18, they weren't in the headspace. So there's so much that really bothers me about it, but I hope that I channel that into having interesting conversations like this.
So
also saying, you know what, when I'm working, I try and counter that. I try and plug the gaps, and I'd like to hopefully talk to people who can do something about it. I'm no interest in politics or policy in terms of doing it myself, but I would be happy to talk to some of the people that do and get them to think about it. Because I'm an educator, I'm not a policy writer.
So you started a business rather than teach.
I did.
I mean, was it a new business? Did you just take on this company as it was, or did you start something completely brand new?
So half and half. I guess it's a bit complicated, or at least it feels it, because basically I started a business with Krish and Denny, who ran the leadership. So we started it together, and they were kind of on the paperwork, but they left me to it. They were there for moral support, and since then they've retracted their directorships and just said, look, you know what you're doing now. We don't need to be on your paperwork. It's fine. So a lot of it is the same material that I was taught when I was younger, and I've developed it using my education background, using psychology. I read a lot of self-help, well-being to come up with materials. So it's the bulk of the business is delivering soft skills training. But obviously starting a business is not, it's not just the thing that you do. There's all the back end, like, oh my goodness.
There's another hat to be.
I have to learn to be an accountant.
It was a very generous act of them to give you that, wasn't it, really? It was very generous of them to support you totally in that.
Yeah, and I think we'd been working together for 9 years before I got to that point. So there was a great deal of trust. But also what I like about working with charities and working with people like Chris and Denny is that there's a mentality of abundance. The corporate world is quite competitive, and this is my thing and I have to protect it, or I have to be, you know, I have to be reimbursed the right amount. Whereas when you're working with young people, when you're working in education and social enterprise, there's a, well, I'm doing this to make the world a nicer place. And yes, I'd like to put food on the table while doing so. But if you're a nice person, you're going to use it to help people. Why wouldn't I want to share that? So I've really enjoyed going on that journey with them. And we still do bits of work together internationally and nationally. When it comes up, we kind of, they have a slightly different business model now. They do other types of training for different groups, and we collaborate when there's crossover. So yeah, they're very much a part of that journey. And also I've volunteered with a lot of other people along the way who, when I started the business, I said, like, I'm going to start it. I've no idea if I'll be able to employ you or anything, but there'll be times when we can collaborate for sure. And a lot of them wanted a normal job, and that's fine. But when I'm doing big events, we're a bit like a family, and they'll come in and help out, and we get to see each other and things. So there's a real sense of community, because we spent our young adult years learning who we were together.
Yeah.
And there's just a real... there's something really special about that.
Do you know, that is so valuable. The relationships you build when you go through something like that together, bond and the friendship they form is huge. Mm. And the same can be said probably for some university friends, and the same can be said from what you're doing here. So it's, I recognize how valuable that is, that shared experience thing.
I've done lots of events and conferences since, again, mostly with Chris and Denny, where we try and bring young people together to like do workshops, listen to keynote speakers, and have, I guess, what you call spiritual moments, but not in a religious way, inner listening and meditation and working out who you are kind of thing. And I think what I noticed in mainstream education or the rest of society is people make friends based on, we like the same music, we like the same TV, and that's fine. But actually, when you throw people together and say, what do you value in life? What drives you? What's your passion? Have you found your meaning yet? And those kind of things, people bond in a whole different way. And then it doesn't matter if they're different religions or like different TV shows or all this other stuff. I've met such a diverse group of people from being able to have those deep conversations that, again, you don't really get taught how to do that very often. And so I really love teaching people to do that, because it helps them to reconnect with friends and family in a way that they haven't done before. And sometimes it's always positive, but the caveat to that is that sometimes people realize, I don't have the same values as my friend. And now that I know that, how do I deal with that? Do I still want to be around this person who actually, we've got a lot in common on the surface, but they're going in a very different direction, and maybe they pull me down in ways I didn't notice. And that's a really big issue for young people, but obviously for anybody. You find it in toxic workplace cultures. It's so subtle that nobody picks up on it, but there's this kind of difficulty because people aren't good at talking about the deep stuff.
Yeah, true, very true. I mean, I met my wife on a workshop we were both assisting on the back. It's a creativity workshop that was running for many, many years. And we'd both done the workshop several times. So we came back to work behind the scenes. But one of the things I always was fascinated by is the fact that you'd bring this eclectic group of people together on a Friday evening, you know, all sorts of people who would kind of look furtively at each other, you know, the guy covering the tattoos and the businessman in the suit, this sort of stuff. And all these range of people coming together. And by Sunday afternoon, they're all sharing each other's snot as they sob on each other's shoulders, you know. It's like, you know, and it's like you kind of say, like, you know, you realise that we're all different, but we're all the same. And it's quite fascinating when you get to that level, really.
Yeah.
And as the leaders always said, we didn't bust these people specially in for you. This is a random selection of people and they're out there for you to meet too. You know, it's just how it is.
Yeah. It's just creating the right space sometimes for people to get there.
It is fascinating. So look, it's a lovely journey. Thank you for the exploration of your life. And it's interesting. I can hear the passion in how you talk about it. I can really see that.
Oh, thank you.
Success is an interesting one. You've talked on it, and obviously you've thought about these questions deeply that I'm going to ask you, because obviously you live them, so I'm expecting some good answers from you. No pressure.
Although I'm a bit worried, maybe I'm too busy living them to articulate them well. We'll see how we go.
No, anyway, I mean, yeah, there's no right answer to any of these, because they're a personal answer, aren't they, really? So what's success mean to you? I mean, success for you, obviously a successful business would be nice, but you know, what does that mean? What does that look like?
I do find that, even though it's not a difficult question, I immediately find it difficult, because I know that school tries to teach you that success is getting a good job, earning money, getting a house, having a family, stuff. And well, so I immediately culture. Resist
that's
not, a bit.
That's school.
I know.
That's just the culture thing. And it's a safety net, isn't it? It's like, if we make sure everybody goes and does this sort of thing, then we don't have to pay them. We can look after them. You know, that's what it's about, I guess, really.
But it's interesting that I have that reaction to it, because that tells me that I feel like my view of success is different to what's normal. And so I feel a bit, I don't know how I feel about that. So
secret
for me,
for
success.
You. I've got a secret for you. There ain't no normal.
Yeah. So, I mean, for me, success is good health. It's having enough money to just live in a house, hopefully with a garden one day, so I can grow my own fruit and veg. I would love to homeschool my own children. I need to learn more about how to do that. I need to have some children. Success is helping people. I've never been interested in sort of status, fancy job titles. And when I go to business marketing and workshops, they say, like, what's your ideal turnover? Don't care. It's not about, I just want to help lots of people and be healthy and happy doing it, and have time in my week for my friends, my family, and my hobbies along the way. So there's no definite recipe. I think if you're balanced all the way through life, you don't have to count down to retirement and, I'll be happy and successful then. It's no, enjoy every day. That's success.
Yeah, it's like, it's fine, isn't it? I mean, whatever it is, I think there's always going to be a time when there needs to be some resource acquisition. So success might be that. And, you know, and it might be that you turn around and say, well, look, if you do the numbers and look at your business, you might say, look, if I was to hit a turnover of $500,000 in this business, I could have major more impact. So that's what that's what some people do. I mean, you know, Elon Musk must be looking at the impact he wants to create. He's prepared to crash a number of, you know, ships and however many millions they cost him, you know. But at the same, you know, everyone has their own determination for success. Mm. I have to question Branson's and Bezos' success, because I don't think space tourism is it. But am I getting political there? Perhaps I should shut my face.
But then more people should get political.
I can't see the bloody point in taking up a ship up that far and that much carbon for that much time. But hey, there you go. Who am I to say? Each of us has to define our own success for ourselves.
Yeah.
But the point about it is, I think, the reason this success question is there, it's not about how you define the sex, but the fact that you do.
Yeah. And a lot of people plod along, don't they, without knowing what they're aiming for.
That is the important point, that you have got something that you can call that was a success.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, for me, what has been amazing, I wanted to get this podcast shown on some of the podcast apps. And this last 2 weeks, we've started to peer in some of the categories. And I'm kind of going, that is a bigger success for me than I've ever seen. That's for me means I've made it, because I'm now starting to get seen in podcast categories of self-help and education. And like, brilliant, that's what I wanted to do.
Now, and
there's no way of forcing that. That has to happen organically. I can't persuade them to do that. They've got to do that by saying that this podcast is a success. Yeah. Hey, someone else thinks it is.
You've got to have that kind of consistency of, this is how I'm going to behave, that will eventually, it might get me there, but even if it doesn't, I've enjoyed the journey.
Enjoying the journey is very important. Absolutely. So look, I know that you do this, but we'll ask you what you think it is. Contribution. How do you contribute to the world?
I help people to understand themselves better, and I give people tools that I think allows them to choose different ways of being. And I've chosen that language carefully, because I have a lot of people say, oh, I've got this conflict, how do I solve it? There's no one answer, but what I can do is get you to think about all these questions, to know all these different communication techniques, and then you've got to work out which one you want to implement yourself. So I think it's about helping people to navigate their lives a little bit more mindfully, so that they can hopefully work out what they want and get there a bit better, a bit easier.
Fantastic. How do you contribute to yourself?
I just look after myself. I mean, I say that like it's obvious, but I know some people don't. I do a gratitude journal every night, and I have done for the last 6 years. I think that's really important for my mindset. For many years, I ignored the body. I've always been an intellectual. I've always been interested in kind of the self-help psychology stuff. And so a couple of years ago, I turned vegan for ethical reasons, but that started me thinking about my nutrition and exercise. I've never really liked exercise, because I'm a thinker, not a mover, but I'm now appreciating the need to bring the brain and body into alignment, and I do stretches and things. But I contribute to myself, I think, by being aware that there's your intellect, there's your emotions, there's your body, there's your social relationships, and there's your spirituality as well. And I'm not religious, but I do make time for reflection and pondering meaning. And so every week, I would say I'm always doing things that tick off those areas. And that's how I look after myself and contribute. So I don't need to worry about a destination in the future, because every day is nice, because I'm doing all those things.
Gosh, you are such a model, such a model guest. it's fascinating, isn't it? Because, I mean, I always talk about this, because my returning to exercise was in my early 50s. And I looked at my father, the state of my father's knees at the time, and thought, if I don't do something about my body, I will end up somewhere on those lines. And so I did return to exercise. And this weekend just gone, I did a 5K race in 22 minutes and 48 seconds.
That sounds fast. I'd have no idea, but that sounds good.
For someone who's 58, it is bloody fast. And it was hot, and it was really hot. And I was aiming for 21, and I know I can get to 21. I know I can meet 21 minutes. So it's like, and of course, because it's like, I'm very proud of it, so I keep telling everybody.
why not? It keeps you accountable, but the more people you tell about your goals and passions, the more you step your game up.
Yeah, but the weird thing is about it, isn't it? Like, you talk about you came back to the body. If you'd have said to me 5 years ago you would be running and enjoying running and doing a lot of running and improving times, you know, and reading books about running and about VO2 max and about, you know, and I'd have gone, no way, I don't do running.
So, well, I mean, I now get up at 7, which is early for me, but I'm getting a routine, and I start my day with some white tea and some Japanese these exercises. And again, if you'd have said to me a year ago, oh, you're going to be doing exercise once a day, I'd go, I don't like that. But again, I think we come at things when we're ready.
Yeah, we do.
And yeah, I read the book Ikigai, the yes. Japanese art to a happy life.
Yeah.
And I kind of thought, oh, I keep teaching people about how to have a good life. And like, oh, there's still things about me that I need to, or not that I need. Need implies urgency, implies pressure. There's things that I still want to do because I know I can make my own life a bit nicer. And be
it's a whole package, isn't it? I mean, you've developed the emotion, the intelligence side, you know, the leadership side. But what you get to realize as you age is that it's a whole package. You need to get it all. It needs to be complete. And the more complete it is, the easier it is to life, and the more it all falls together. So look, what's the one question that you like people to ask you?
It was phrased a bit differently before.
You can have this question how you like. You can have it as like, what's the one question I didn't ask you that I should have done?
Yeah.
Or you can have it, what's the one question more people ask themselves? I don't mind how you choose that question. This is your opportunity to say what you like.
I'd read What's the Question You Wish People Asked? And I was thinking at a society level, I wished people asked, what's the purpose of education?
It's a damn good question, that one. I could probably wax lyrical on that one as well, but I'll go with your answer.
Just because, as the whole thread of this podcast is, and I don't mean it in like a flip of what's the point. I mean, no, what are we trying to achieve? Because I feel like we're not doing it, and nobody stopped to ask. You know, okay, we've got somebody who we want to turn into a well-rounded adult. What are we going to educate them to get them there? What skills? What knowledge? What do we want them to know about? How do we want them to feel? And how do we use our knowledge of pedagogy, the science of learning, to get there? Nobody's asking these things. They're just, oh, well, we've got schools, that'll do. And because nobody's asking, we're kind of stagnating. And so I say nobody's asking, there obviously are. And a lot of interesting charities come up with new things, but the people who've got the power don't seem to ask. And so
I think the problem you've hit there is that they don't know themselves. And the problem you've hit there is the bigger problem for wider society. The problem from what I've done a lot of these podcasts, I had a lot of conversations with a lot of people. And one thing I'm getting really clear on now is that we don't know what humanity is for. We don't know what our purpose is, what we're for. So without actually having a purpose for bloody being here, other than proliferation and consumption, we can't teach it. I mean, all we can do is teach humans to be rounded humans, which would be a bloody good start. So, yeah, you're right. That's the difficulty is there's no one actually having these conversations like, what is the purpose of it? What are we here for? Because if you ask each person in society, they'd have a different viewpoint. Ask the politicians.
And you might end up...
Ask the politicians. It's growth, unlimited growth.
Which, again, a bit like the whole paradox of the average, unlimited growth. Well, it's got to stop somewhere because then you use everything up. At what point do we stop growing and just say, you know what, that's comfortable. That's enough.
Yeah, so. Well, that we don't do enough, do we? That's the problem, isn't it? Really, it's the problem.
Yeah.
Oh, it's a fascinating question. There's a big rabbit hole there. I think I better avoid that one because I could go diving down that one. Yeah, it's a total mystery.
And also, I guess as well, you know, what's the purpose of education? My passion is young people. I work with adults, young people. I work with anybody who wants training. But sometimes people think education is just about young people and they forget that adults still need education as well. And so that's a subpart of the question. What's the purpose of education for lifelong learning, not just the first 18 years? There's still a lot to be done there.
Back to lighting the fire, isn't it, really?
Yeah, for sure.
What's the story with your siblings nowadays? Where are they, and how did their life turn out in terms of education and stuff?
Not without challenges.
Okay. I wasn't going to dig deep, but I just you mentioned early on, but you know, because obviously they were the seed and the thing that started this journey for you in some ways.
In many ways, the system isn't built for them. And so my youngest brother went to a special needs school, which took care of a lot of his pastoral needs, but meant that he had no qualifications, which made things difficult. My sister went to a mainstream school, which took care of her academic needs, but socially she got bullied a lot because the kids didn't understand autism. My older, younger brother, he is more Asperger's. He sort of got by. He did a degree, did a master's, and he now teaches English in South Korea. You know, varying experiences, but I think, again, it just highlights that the system is very much built for the conveyor belt, as Ken Robinson said. Everybody's put through the same Play-Doh press. And if you're not quite built for that, it throws up problems that a lot of other people wouldn't even think about. And so they're still dealing with some of the aftermath of some of those things. There's been a lot of advantages to the way they think, and you know, they see the world differently. But there's an awful lot more challenges that still have an impact on them as individuals and us as a family as well, trying to still work out how we navigate that.
I will post the on the podcast, for the benefit of my listeners, I will post on the podcast a link to Ken Robinson's video. There was a video he did with the RCA, which was basically a lecture that he did, and then they animated it with some, and the animation's very funny and it's quite entertaining to listen to. But I mean, he does talk about how education was designed basically for the factory system, and we educate children like factories. And he says, we educate children based on data manufacture, which when you think about it is pretty crazy, because obviously not everyone's the same. So yeah. So I will post that video, because I think it's quite an interesting thing, anyone who wants to follow up more on that one. And well, wonderful. So obviously you have this business. You are now, does it work with charities? Does it work? Who does it work with? And what does it seek to do? And who are you looking to speak to?
I'm not so good at niching. I work with anybody who'll have me.
Well, if you did niche, it would be more thorough. So perhaps you ought to probably pick one.
So I do a lot of work with student unions, because they're young people. They've got a lot of officers, the student body. I work with corporates mostly on well-being. I work with charities on how they kind of facilitate groups and do a lot of their building leadership and teams as they're starting out or as they're developing. But I also work with teachers on how to improve their coaching, because when I was doing my teacher training, I came out the other end and went, you didn't teach us coaching. Oh, no, we don't do that. Like, what? Why not? So I do different things for different groups, but broadly speaking, anybody who wants soft skills, I've got different bespoke pack. That's an oxymoron. You don't have a bespoke package. I work in a bespoke way with people, so I've got kind of ideas of things that I do, but it's always tailored to the group. And I kind of say, well, what's your problem? What's the skill set that's missing? Why do you want that? And let me design you either a one-off workshop or a program or a series of coaching to kind of address it. And I do work with individuals as well, mostly on their personal well-being. And I have a program that's open for anybody called Tools for Happier Living, which takes neuroscience and positive psychology and helps people to work out how to implement it in their day-to-day. So anybody who's a, you know, HR manager or runs a small company or manages a team who wants to develop soft skills somewhere within their group can book a meeting with me and just tell me about their context and we'll have a conversation about it.
Wonderful. Well, that would be a lovely conversation to have. So how do they find you? And how do they get in touch with you?
So you can find me on LinkedIn by looking for Gemma Perkins, and my company is called The Self Leadership Initiative, which is very long. So the web address is thesli.co.uk. And if you go on there, there's a booking form. You can see some free resources. There's lots of blog articles for people to get thinking about different topics around emotional intelligence.
Wonderful, wonderful. And are you on other social channels?
My company is. I don't bother personally as much, but I put content out across all of them. But LinkedIn is where I spend more of my
LinkedIn
time.
Is the place to be. Absolutely. Okay. Well, all those links will be available at the website lifepassionandbusiness.com, as well as that video from Ken Robinson. And that's about it. So lovely. Thank you so much for that conversation. So we get to the final conversation, which is the big one, which we've touched on a couple of times in this podcast. What is the meaning of life for you?
So
You froze for a minute. I thought, I've lost the conversation.
I did. I'm thinking, I'm going to layer it into two parts. So for me, I spent a long time in January. I was in India, and my life purpose is to inspire and empower other people to be their best selves.
Mm.
And I think the inspire is I want them to be excited about it. I want them to think it's possible. The empower is giving the tools, and then best self I've left open-ended, that it's whatever that means to them. That's very much for me, but I was thinking in general, I met a lady who worked in education, and she believed people's purpose was to work out what their unique gifts were and use them to serve the world. And I think that's a really good generic life purpose for everybody to think about, is my gifts are education and training, and so that's how it manifests for me. But somebody else might have the gift of, I don't know, persuasion or artistry or music or numbers.
Yeah, crafting.
So I think if you can find what it is you're good at that helps to serve another person, then you're well on your way to finding the meaning of life for you.
Lovely. Well, thank you so much. Gemma Perkins,
thank you very much for having me.
It has been wonderful to have you on the show and have this conversation. All the best.
And that was Life, Passion and Business with Paul Harvey and my guest, Gemma Perkins. As you heard on the program, her work is about leadership and emotional intelligence. If you'd like to explore that for yourself or for your organization, do get in touch. You will find her at the Self Leadership Initiative. That's thesli.co.uk. Gemma is not big on social media, but she is on LinkedIn, and the organization can be found on LinkedIn, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube, where you will also find some great videos. All of those links can be found at the website lifepassionandbusiness.com. And while you're there, do check out our resources and tools to support you on this journey, this wonderful journey we call life. So as always, thank you so much for being here on this journey with me. If you've enjoyed this program, please share it with a friend, because that's how people find good podcasts. And as always, thank you for your time and attention. I'll catch you next time. All the best.